Basically, what I would like to do this evening is to discuss with you Tanakh. Specifically, we'll talk about Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, how these sections relate to each other. And I hope in the process we'll offer perhaps a critique of the present state of what can be called canonical studies. I'll begin by presenting to you what you would find in the biblical handbooks. You examine those handbooks to find out what modern Protestant scholars are saying about the biblical canon, about the collection of books that we call Tanakh. I hope to offer a critique of that and to discuss with you some other options that we find specifically in rabbinic literature of various periods. And we will, among others, at some point, we'll study some of the most interesting comments of several great Sephardic leaders, in particular Don Yitzchak Abarbanel. But we'll come to that later. Of course, we have many great Mefarshim who have helped us understand what Tanakh is all about. And anyone here, and I take it if you're here, you're spending a lifetime studying Tanakh, you know full well how important Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Radak, Abarbanel, and so on are for understanding the plain sense of Tanakh, as well as for understanding Chazal's interpretations of Tanakh. And however much they have contributed to our understanding of Tanakh, they tell us very little about how Tanakh was formed. Virtually nothing. Who wrote these books? Who gathered them together? Why are they divided into the three sections called Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim? And I have to tell you that in the newspapers recently, in the last few months, you may have seen it, in Haaretz, in Ma'ariv, there were large reviews of a new major work that has come out on the history of the biblical canon, which has not reached America. It hasn't reached me, at least. And I haven't seen it, but you will see it and when it appears, and we'll all look at it together. Professor Menachem Haran of the Hebrew University has devoted his entire life to these questions. How did the books of Tanakh, how were they gathered together? How were they edited? Who decided which books would be in Tanakh and which books would be excluded from Tanakh? And although I haven't seen his major work yet, but I read the newspapers, and the newspapers have already apparently saw pre-publication copies, and the newspaper said that his theory is, and it's a revolutionary theory, and it was a lot of fanfare, it was written up in the papers, his theory was essentially that what we have in Tanakh is exactly what has been preserved. That is, there was once a larger literature. It was all lost by accident. And Tanakh, in effect, when someone sat down one day and said, let's gather together the books of Tanakh, what he really said was, let's gather together all the books that exist. And in Hebrew, about our history, about our traditions. And they gathered together all those books, and it happened to be there were 24 of them, and we call that Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim. This is Professor Haran's theory. I don't believe it, as will become obvious from the remainder of this presentation. But be aware that there's this major new theory that's about to be published, and already it's been reviewed, and when it's published, it'll be in all the newspapers. I wouldn't be surprised if it would even make the New York Times. It's something astounding. In any event, he is a very great scholar. He spent his whole life studying this, and I can only present to you the conclusions that I saw in the newspapers, namely his basic theory is, as I just said, that all what we have in Tanakh are the remnants of Israelite literature. In other words, no one sat down and investigated a rich literature and said, this book will be in Tanakh and this book will be excluded from Tanakh. According to Haran, it was simply an accident of history. This is what we have, and that's it. But I'm very interested in those larger questions. Who decided which books would be in Tanakh? When was this decision made? Why was the biblical canon closed? Somewhere along the line, someone made a decision and said, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Divrei Hayamim, that's it. And after Divrei Hayamim, no other history book can get into the Tanakh. Why? What was wrong with the history of the 4th century or the 3rd century B.C.? We just celebrated Hanukkah. a wonderful book called First Maccabees and Second Maccabees and the Apocrypha. It's a wonderful history. Why couldn't that get into Tanakh? Not in Tanakh. Who made these decisions? Why? Is it possible that Tanakh once included books that are now excluded from Tanakh? Did we once have a larger Tanakh? And let me assure you, even if I don't get to it tonight, that there are such viewpoints expressed by famous rabbis in Jewish history. There are those who hold that there were once other books in Tanakh, and they actually give us the names of those books. But they were once included in Tanakh, and then they were excluded from Tanakh. We all know that there's a collection of books called the Apocrypha, which is part of the Christian Bible, but it's not part of the Hebrew Bible. I'm referring to books like Susanna, beautiful book, Judith, another beautiful book, Yehudit, Ben-Sira, cited in the Talmud, wonderful books. Read Ben-Sira and read Mishlei, very hard to tell the difference. Mishlei is in Tanakh, and Ben-Sira is not in Tanakh. Ben-Sira is in the Apocrypha. Why? There's another group of books called the Pseudepigrapha, in case you're ever asked on a quiz program. And the Pseudepigrapha are those books that didn't make it into the Apocrypha. And they include some very ancient books, and also very beautiful books, and very important books. One of those books in the Pseudepigrapha, that is a book that not only is not in Tanakh, but is not in the Apocrypha, is a book called Jubilees, Sefer HaYovelim, very important book. The Book of Jubilees has to be one of the oldest books in existence. It's certainly as old as many books in Tanakh. But it's not in Tanakh. And it's not only not in Tanakh, as I say, it's not even in the Apocrypha. How come? So these are all some of the kinds of questions that interest me very much. Now, very briefly, what I'd like to present is a survey of what you will find if you examine modern scholarship. What they will tell you about some of these matters, and specifically about the history of Tanakh per se, Torah, Neviim, and Ketuvim. And if you examine the modern literature, what you would find is the following. You would find that in modern scholarship, the claim is that the Torah was the first book of Tanakh. There was once a time when the Torah itself was the entire biblical canon. There were no other books. And if you would look at this introductory literature to the history of Tanakh, they would tell you that the period when the Torah became the official canonical book of all Jews, they will not tell you that it was in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, they will tell you it was in the time of the 5th or 4th century, in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. So the first book of Tanakh, as far as modern scholarship is concerned, the first book to be canonical, I want to stress the fact that I'm not talking about dating specific biblical books. Sefer Iyov may be one of the oldest books of the Bible, maybe even be older than the Torah. That's not what modern scholarship is talking about. Modern scholarship is asking not how old a book is, but when did a book become the authoritative, official book by which people lived, a book that people studied. That's what they're asking. They're not asking who wrote Sefer Iyov and when was it published. That's one question. It's an interesting question in and of itself. But they're asking a far more important question, for my purposes, when did Iyov become part of Tanakh, if I use Iyov as the model? When did all of Jewry recognize that Iyov has a special status? It is a book that you study in the Beit HaMidrash. It is a book that rabbis can cite in their drashot. It is a book that anyone who studies Tanakh studies that book as well, and so on. When did that happen? And that's a separate question from who authored it, and when it was written. And I want to stress that. So it's very possible, for example, that Yeshayahu wrote Sefer Yeshayahu and wrote the Nevuot in Sefer Yeshayahu, but that doesn't tell you when the book of Yeshayahu became a canonical book. That's a separate question. So modern scholarship says the Torah was the first book of the Bible, and once it was the entire Bible. There were no other books in the Bible. Horaya. How do they know that? Because the Samaritans have the Torah. We're not the only Jewish group, you see, that has the Torah. There's another group of people still alive, not so well, but still alive in Shechem, in Nablus, on Mount Gerizim, the remnants of the Shomronim, the Samaritans, still around. In the Talmud, they're called Kutim. And there's a whole tractate devoted to them, Sechet Kutim. The Shomronim still live. The Shomronim were a group of Jews who broke away from normative Judaism, developed in their own sectarian way. They bring a Korban Pesach every Pesach to this day, unlike us. Quite an amazing group. They have a Kohen Gadol to this very day. And what does their Bible look like? It's a good test. Take a look at their Bible. They only have the Torah. They have nothing else. Torah. They have a Sefer Yehoshua, but the Sefer Yehoshua they have is not our Sefer Yehoshua. It's a medieval work. And as a matter of fact, the Samaritans in antiquity only had Torah. Sefer Yehoshua that they have was added in the medieval period. And as I say, it's not the same as our Sefer Yehoshua. It's really a midrash on Yehoshua. So essentially, they have the Bible. That's it. They have the Torah. And what scholars said is, if you read Josephus, the historian, and so on, and go back to your records, you'll find out that the major split between the Shomronim and the Jews occurred about the 4th, 3rd century B.C. Alexander the Great played a major role in the secession of the Samaritans from the rest of Jewry. From that time on, they developed one way and we developed another way. Since they have only the Torah, and we have Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, modern scholarship says the answer is that once there was only Torah, when they broke away from us, that was at a point when there was only Torah, so they have Torah and we have Torah. And when after they broke away from us, at some later point, we established the other sections called Nevi'im and Ketuvim. And when was the section Nevi'im established? What are we going to use for evidence? What are we going to use for evidence to prove that there's a section called Nevi'im? Here there's, methodologically, it's very important to spell out what we should do, it seems to me. You can help me if you have other suggestions. How do you know whether a book is part of the Bible? How do you know whether a book is authoritative for all Jews? It's a book to be studied. How do you know? How would you test? If you wanted to test whether a book is part of Tanakh, if I asked you, is the Book of Mormon part of the Jewish Tanakh? How would you know that it's not part of Tanakh? What would be the answer to the question? How would you know that, yes? Okay, you might look in the Talmud. And how does that help you? What would I look for in the Talmud? It's a very good point. What do you really mean by looking in the Talmud? Which books are cited in the Talmud? See, and you're raising a very important point, and it's really the method that I'm interested in. Quotability, to stuff for starters. Quotability. In other words, anybody here who studies Talmud will know that in Talmud, whenever a verse is cited from Tanakh, it's preceded almost always by Sheneemar, or Dichtiv. There's a certain formula in the Talmud. Whenever a biblical verse is cited, it'll say Shene'emar, usually Shene'emar, or Dichtiv, and then follows the... In fact, very ordinarily, the name of the biblical book is not cited. Talmud assumes you know. If you see a verse, the Talmud assumes you know where the verse is from. Every Jew knew Tanakh by heart, apparently, once upon a time. Certainly the Tanaim and Amorim knew Tanakh by heart, yes. Okay, so we're going to have to be careful. Good, terrific. But at the very least, we start with quotability. Surely a book cannot be authoritative for Jewish study and for Jewish practice if it's never cited by Jews. The answer is, let's look at our literature, let's see what we cite. Another fine way of doing it is to listen to a rabbi every Shabbat in his drasha. What does he cite? He's not going to cite Matthew, he's not going to cite the Book of Mormon, he's going to cite Pesukim. You see where the Pesukim come from, you have an idea what Tanakh looks like. So if we talk about quotability, it's very important. It's a good beginning. With the proviso, we're going to have to say more than just quotability, because you asked quite correctly, Ben Sirah is also cited in the Talmud. And indeed, that's precisely why some authorities thought that Ben Sirah is indeed part of Tanakh. Einachinami. So we'll have to refine a little bit what we mean by quotability. But at the very least, as a minimum, if a book isn't quoted, and if it's not cited, obviously it can't be part of Tanakh. Now, if you ask yourself about Nevi'im, I just want to get to this Nevi'im part. Ask yourself, where is the first time in Jewish history that Nevi'im are cited? that's going to tell us when it became part of the Bible. If when I have evidence that a book of Nevi'im is cited by somebody, and specifically cited as authoritative, then I have my answer, right? Now, if you read Yoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Melachim, even Yishayahu, Yirmiyah, and Yecheskel, what? They cite the Torah. And what don't they cite? They cite the Torah, but they don't cite other books. Not other Nevi'im. In other words, you can read Sefer Yishayahu. Sefer Yishayahu never says, Ki dichtiv b'sefer Melachim. You see, now I'm pointing out the methodology, what we have to use to find out what was part of Tanakh when. The Torah is cited, you're absolutely right, in Sefer Melachim. It says, as it is written in Torah, Moshe, in Sefer HaTorah, actually says that. We have quotes from the Sefer Torah. Somebody does a certain practice, and he follows the law in the Torah, Lo yumtu avot al banim, etc. For those of you who are familiar with the verses. But does Yishayahu ever cite Yoshua? Does Yirmiyahu ever cite Yishayahu? The answer is, in a certain sense, yes, but never by name. Never by name. Nobody cites a previous book of a Navi, which tends to support, by the way, modern scholarship, which says, well, you really want to know what Tanakh looked like in the earliest stages, there was Torah. That's it. Doesn't mean there weren't Nevi'im. It doesn't even mean that they didn't write books. All it means is no one gathered them together yet to one unique group called Nevi'im. And when can I prove that that happened? When I can show you that somebody cites a Sefer and says, Ki dichtiv b'sefer Yishayahu.
But they don't all cite the Torah.
No, they don't. No, they don't all. You're right.
Right, so
no, some do and some don't.
The fact that they're not citing the other Nevi'im, the later Nevi'im, right?
Right.
They're not citing writing is not so clear. I mean, if we see influence, that's a different matter.
Okay, the problem with influence, if you mean did one biblical prophet influence another, and there are methods of studying that, as you of course will know, the problem with influence is, all influence tells me is that A read B, or A knew about B's teaching. Influence doesn't prove to me that that other book, the book that influenced him, was part of Tanakh. Well, absolutely.
There's no citability
right.
Of the
right.
Torah and Lav Nevi'im. But if it can show that there's influence from something previously and a faithfulness to that source, that would be something.
Okay, and influence would be helpful. And indeed, scholars have studied, and there is influence, make no mistake about it. Sefer Yirmiyahu and Sefer Yecheskel, just to give you a sample, there's clear influence from one to the other. One can't claim that, even though you will never find in Sefer Yecheskel, for example, that Yecheskel says, as Yirmiyahu Hanavi wrote, and then he cites a verse in the name of Yirmiyahu. No such thing. No such thing in all of Nevi'im and Ketuvim. No Navi cites another Navi by name in that sense. But influence, and sometimes almost the exact words reappear in Tunavim, absolutely, influence exists. But, as I say, influence will tell us a little bit, but it's not going to really be a proof for what did the canon of Tanakh look like. Yes?
You talked about that some of the fact that they only have Torah, that the canon of the Torah at the 3rd or 4th century, but it could be that the Nevi'im were canonized too, but they rejected them.
Very good. That, and I actually wrote that in print many years ago. So I agree with you. That's a fine response. I agree with you. I was presenting what modern scholarship says. I didn't get to my criticism yet. All right? But I agree with you fully. It's very possible. In other words, what was being suggested here quite correctly is, you know, it's possible that Nevi'im were part of Tanakh in the time of the Samaritans, in the 3rd, 4th century BCE. It's possible. And it's possible, just like the Samaritans broke away from the Jewish people and built a temple on Mount Gerizim instead of in Jerusalem, so they also rejected Nevi'im. And they have a very good reason for rejecting Nevi'im, because Yerushalayim is a major city, well known to the Nevi'im. It's the central place of worship. The Makom Asher Yivchar in the Torah becomes Jerusalem in all of Nevi'im. So once they rejected Jerusalem, of course they would have to reject the Nevi'im as well. You're 100% right. But you're running ahead of us. So, yes. Okay. What do you want to prove from the Septuagint? That, okay, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of Scripture, begins with only a translation of Torah. In other words, in the 3rd century B.C., it's interesting, when we have the story of how the librarians in Alexandria wanted to include the Hebrew Bible in their library. They come to Yerushalayim, and they reach an agreement with the high priest in Jerusalem. 72 people are locked into a room, and they produce a translation. If you read the letter of Aristeus, the letter of Aristeus, which is our earliest source for the history of the translation of the Septuagint, and is a book that is included in the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, the letter of Aristeus says only the Torah was translated. Only the Torah. And even if you read some of the versions in Chazal, it was only the Torah that's described as being translated, not Nevi'im and Ketuvim. We know that later, much later than the 3rd century B.C., eventually all of Nevi'im and all of Ketuvim was also translated, so that the Septuagint manuscripts that exist now in libraries throughout the world have the entire Bible, not just the Torah. So I'm not sure what you could prove from that. It probably suggests that at least initially the Torah was viewed as the book, and whenever these people in Alexandria found out that there's a book that the Jews have which they venerate, what they learned about first was the Torah, and that's what was translated first. I don't know whether I can derive from that that Nevi'im didn't exist yet, or you know, but I doubt it.
Question: how does the Samaritan text of the Torah agree or disagree with our text of the Torah?
We're going to take that up perhaps next lecture, not now, okay? Because now we're talking about the formation of the biblical canon, not the history of the text per se. So modern scholarship said Torah first. That was once the Bible. Then they said a group of famous rabbis must have gotten together, perhaps 3rd, 4th, 3rd century, 2nd century, who knows, B.C., nobody knows for sure, and gathered together their national history, because you see the Torah begins with the creation of the world and ends with the death of Moshe. Well, what happened after the death of Moshe? So someone sat down, or some group, some committee got together and said, we need the rest of our history. What happened from the death of Moshe down through the history of all our kings and prophets? And if you read Yoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Melachim, it's in chronological order. Yoshua picks up exactly where the Torah ends, continues the national history, and that national history continues through Sefer Divrei HaYamim, and it ends with the exile, the destruction of the first temple, and the exile to Babylon. So sometime after that exile, perhaps when the group returned to Eretz Yisrael, it was found that it was necessary to write the national history. The books were gathered together, and that's how Nevi'im were formed. So modern scholarship. And their proof, remember the methodology we began with, you need to have some evidence that somebody's quoting these Nevi'im. If no one's quoting the Nevi'im, then you have no proof that Nevi'im exists. Who is the first person to quote Nevi'im? As far as modern scholarship is concerned, who is the first person to quote Nevi'im? Ben Sira. We have the book called Ben Sira, a beautiful book in the Apocrypha, cited by the Chachamim, and Ben Sira lived about 190 B.C. We know precisely more or less when he lived, 190 B.C. And Ben Sira, not only does he cite Nevi'im, but more importantly, Ben Sira gives a list of the biblical books. Don't need any better than that. Ben Sira has an ode to the biblical heroes. He has a poem at the end of Sefer Ben Sira where he praises the great biblical heroes. And he speaks about Yoshua and then the famous judges in Shoftim and then Shmuel. And he goes in the order and he speaks about Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel. He lists the books. And he has them in the exact order that we have them. He has a whole list of the biblical heroes starting from Yoshua. although he doesn't quote all these biblical books, but it's clear from his list of biblical heroes and the people that he praises, he had a copy of Nevi'im. There's no question about it. He had a copy of Nevi'im in front of him. So in 190 B.C., we have the first evidence for something called Nevi'im. And by the way, I remind you, remember, which I take it you all understand, and a very simple matter, and that is, we have no copies of Torah and Nevi'im from the 5th century B.C., from the 4th century B.C. We don't have no such copies. Our Sifrei Torah are all written in the last 1,000 years. And the Dead Sea Scrolls now have been, of course, recovered, and we've spoken about it in the past, and you all know about the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls will get us back to about 200 B.C., in most instances, the earliest. So we have nothing before 200 B.C. It's not as if we have a copy of Tanakh that I could tell you, look, here we have a copy, and we're going to have to discuss the matter. We have a whole set of Tanakh. We don't have copies from those earlier periods. We believe, we traditional Jews, we say, of course, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the Torah, and the various Nevi'im wrote the Nevi'im, and those books existed, but the fact is that we have no copies from those earlier periods. We can't prove it scientifically. On the other hand, what we can prove scientifically, and that's what modern scholarship says, is that Nevi'im, more or less as we know it, were in the hands of the author of Ben Sira, Yehoshua Ben Sira. So, let's say by 190 B.C., if you like, 200 B.C., by 200 B.C., there's no question Nevi'im exists, and Nevi'im already is treated as canonical, it is authoritative. Ben Sira can cite stories about Moshe, Aaron, and continue from Yehoshua down through Ezra. So, clearly, Nevi'im existed already in the time of Ben Sira. But if Ben Sira mentions the famous Nevi'im, and he mentions, indeed, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yecheskel, he says nothing about Ketuvim. He doesn't mention Daniel, doesn't mention Megillat Esther, and many of the other books that make up Ketuvim. So modern scholarship said, Torah, well, let's say about 500, 400 B.C. About 200 B.C., Nevi'im was added. And what about Ketuvim? Where did Ketuvim come from? When did Ketuvim become part of Tanakh? So the answer is, who's the first person to cite Mishle? Where do we find verses cited for Mishle? Then we'll know. Or other books of where is Shir HaShirim cited for the first time? And what's the answer? Where are these books cited for the first time? Okay, we have copies in the Dead Sea Scrolls now. That's absolutely true. And those are the oldest copies. But those are pretty late. That's first sentence. Dead Sea Scrolls are older than Josephus. I'm saying, but Dead Sea Scrolls, we actually have copies. You don't have to say. We have Dead Sea Scrolls. We have copies of all the biblical books. We have copies of Mishle, Shir HaShirim. But they'll go back to, those copies of the Dead Sea Scrolls will get us back to about 100 B.C. 100 B.C. on the average, okay? So, modern scholarship said, Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim developed through stages. First Torah, 200 years later Nevi'im were added. And by the way, they don't say that it was 100 B.C. that Ketuvim was added. They say that it was in the time of the Chachamim of the Mishnah. Because all of you who know Mishnah will know that there's a famous debate in Masechet Yadayim, Mishnah Yadayim, where some say that Shir HaShirim, Kohelet Metameyet Yadayim, and others say Kohelet is not Metameyet Yadayim. A technical phrase which was understood by many to mean, and they may be right, that it's a biblical book. Either Kohelet is part of the Bible, or Kohelet is not part of the Bible. Rabbi Shimon ben Menasya, in a famous passage, in a famous Braita, in the Tosefta, Rabbi Shimon ben Menasya says that Kohelet is not Metameyet Yadayim. Kohelet is technically not a biblical book. Ela Chachmato Shel Shlomo. It is the wisdom of Solomon, whatever that means. It can't be too bad if it's the wisdom of Solomon. But that's not quite Tanakh. So the rabbis were discussing the status of biblical books, even if many of the Ketuvim already existed in 100 B.C., as we know from the Dead Sea Scrolls. But what modern scholarship says is the final fixing of the biblical canon, the agreement that these 24 books are Tanakh and no other books, can never be part of Tanakh, and no new books can be added to Tanakh. Modern scholarship says that occurred at a famous meeting of the Chachamim in Yavne, which is in the time of Rabban Gamliel, Ben Azai, Ben Zoma. It would be somewhere, let's say, about 135 of the Common Era. 135 of the Common Era. That, in a nutshell, is what you'll find in any introduction to the history of the biblical books. That's the standard view. That's modern scholarship. Okay. Yeah, except, let me spell out the question and then I'll respond immediately. The question that's being asked is that even with regard to a book of Nevi'im, we find that the rabbis discuss whether it should be Ganaz, Bikshu Lignos Sefer Yecheskel. So here I have to tell you very openly the following. Wherever the word Ganaz is used in the Talmud, it means the book is biblical. There's no question about its status. There never was, by the time of the Talmud, there was no question about the status of Sefer Yecheskel. Bikshu Ligno Sefer Yecheskel, and by the way, the term Ganaz is a technical term in the Talmud. It's only used for a Davar Shebikdusha. Only something that's holy is Ganaz. Sefer Torah Shebala, a Sefer Torah that's worn out, therefore you can't read it anymore in a public service. The rule is gonzin oto. Sefer Torah Shebala, you have to ganaz it. Ganaz means withdraw it from circulation. And what does that mean to withdraw from circulation? You're not allowed to destroy it because it has kedusha. It is a holy book. You can't destroy it, but what do you do? What can you do? You can bury it. You can put it, the Talmud says, and how do you bury it? The Talmud says you put it into a jar and you cover it in order to preserve it, and then you bury it. In other words, we never deliberately destroy any davar shebikdusha. That's the lashon ganaz. So ganaz really means it's holy. When they say bikshu ligno sefer Yecheskel, they have no doubts about Yecheskel. Yecheskel is a holy book. Yecheskel is a navi, and it's part of Nevi'im. What bikshu ligno sefer Yecheskel means is that there were problems with sefer Yecheskel. They didn't deny its kedusha. But on the other hand, they had serious problems. They had problems with the Kabbalah at the beginning of the book, with Yecheskel's vision. And they had very serious problems with chapter 40 on of Sefer Yecheskel. Anyone familiar with chapter 40 on will know that there are a series of halachot at the end of Sefer Yecheskel, which it's very hard to square those halachot with the halachot in the Torah. So they decided the better side of wisdom would be withdraw the book from circulation. But just like it says, Sefer Torah Shebala Gonzinoto, they said, but Sefer Torah Shekatvo Min Sorfinoto. And there you see the contrast between Ganaz and Saraf. A Sefer Torah that a heretic wrote is a perfectly fine Sefer Torah. Not one mistake in the Sefer Torah. But it was written by a heretic. A Sefer Torah written by a heretic, you burn it. Destroy it. Has no Kiddushah. You destroy it. Sefer Yecheskel, Kiddushah. So wherever you find in the Talmud that they wanted to be Ganaz, a certain book, there's no question about the Kiddushah of that book. Okay? That's in this quite distinct from the issue of Tumat Yadayim, where when they say that a book is not Metameya Te Yadayim, in effect they're saying it's not a holy book. It has no Kedusha. I want you to know that till now I was talking about modern scholarship. Now I want you to know an ancient Christian tradition, and after I finish with the ancient Christian tradition, I'll come to Jewish traditions. There's an amazing ancient Christian tradition, which I call it Christian because it occurs now in literature that's generally identified as Christian. It may turn out that it's not so Christian. It may turn out that it has good Jewish roots, but we'll worry about that another time. But at least I want you to be aware of the fact that in the books of the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, there are additional books of Ezra that are not part of our Bible. And in one of those books, in what's known as the fourth book of Ezra, it is a book in the Pseudepigrapha, the fourth book of Ezra. It was written in the first century, the fourth book of Ezra, but in the form that we have it now, it has Christian interpolations. Remember that many Jewish books were preserved by Christians. When we talk about Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, our ancestors did not preserve, for the most part, the books of the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. We have them now in English translation because Christians preserved them. They became part of the Roman Catholic Bible. The whole Apocrypha is part of the Roman Catholic Bible. So the book of Maccabees. We all know the story of the Maccabees, right? How do we know the story of the Maccabees? You don't know it from Tanakh. And I'll tell you something else you don't know it from. You don't know it from Talmud either. Judah Maccabee is never mentioned in the Talmud. He's certainly not mentioned in Tanakh. He couldn't be mentioned in Tanakh. But he's not mentioned in the Talmud either. But everybody knows the story of Hanukkah and the wars of Judah Maccabee. You know it because the Christians preserved the book called First Maccabees in their Apocrypha. And now it's available in English translation. Anybody can read it. And we can read it, and we do read it. It's a wonderful book. And we learn the whole story of Hanukkah. But we learn it from a book that was written by a Jew, but it was preserved in Hebrew originally, but it was then translated into Greek. It was preserved by Christians in the Greek Bible. It was then translated into Latin by Jerome, and finally in the King James Version, it was translated from Latin into English, and we now have it in our various English versions. Back to Fourth Book Ezra. Fourth Book of Ezra is one of those books that may have been written by a Jew originally, but was preserved by Christians, and they added Christian lines to the book wherever they felt like. In that book, it says as follows. It's an amazing statement. And it says, Scriptures perished in the captivity of Nebuchadnezzar. And Ezra, in the time of the captivity, became inspired in the exercise of prophecy and restored the whole of ancient scripture. Very interesting. So we have a view that preserved from a book written in the first century, that in a chinami, all of Tanakh existed in the time of Ezra. But it was lost in the captivity, in the Gola. And Ezra became a Navi. And through inspiration, through divine inspiration, Ezra restored all of scripture. In the fourth book of Ezra, it says specifically that God appeared to Ezra, endowed him with divine spirit, and Ezra authored 94 books, so it says in fourth Ezra, from memory, 70 of which were hidden for all time. So if he was given 94 books, 70 were hidden. How much was left? 24, and the 24 became Holy Scripture. This is a view that we find in Christian literature, repeated by many church fathers. It would later influence Jewish thinking. We'll see. But it's a view that we find nowhere in rabbinic literature. Chazal would never say that all of Tanakh was lost and that Ezra restored the Torah from memory. And you know what it says in the Gemara? The Halacha in Yerushalmi, in Gilah, says that, and it's halacha to this day, a scribe who writes a Sefer Torah, any sofer, it's a din in writing a Sefer Torah, a scribe who writes a Sefer Torah must copy from another Sefer Torah. He may not write from memory. It's a famous Gemara. And I personally think that this Gemara, which says, as a halacha, that when you copy a Sefer Torah, you must copy from another Sefer Torah, is lahotzi. From this Christian tradition, you see, it comes to as an argument against the notion that all of Scripture was lost, and Ezra, from memory, restored even the Torah. And what the Gemara says is that can't be. You can't restore the Torah from memory, and if you do, it doesn't count. The Torah is the Torah because we have it every generation. Each child gets it from its parents and so on, and every sofer must copy a Torah from the previous Torah, going back to the Torah of Moshe. No, you're referring to a passage which perhaps we'll discuss at the next session, where the Gemara says that, where Masechet Sofrim at least says, that three different copies of the Torah were found, but they were copies of the Torah, three copies. And they varied from each other, and the rule was, Holchin Achar Harov. They always followed two against the one, but they had texts. They always had texts. Yeah, you could only, that you could do. That's how we write Sifrei Torah today. How do we write a Torah today? If you examine all Sifrei Torah today, they don't agree with each other. They don't all read the same way. There are differences between Sifrei Torah. We'll talk about that next session. But the rule is, Holka Nacha Harov. In each community, you have to sit down and count the readings of the Sifrei Torah, and you follow the majority readings. And it's based on that passage in Masechet Sofrim, which is also Yerushalmi Tanit, that you just mentioned. Okay, but notice, there they have texts. What Fourth Ezra said is that Ezra restored all of Tanakh from memory. What's important about this tradition from Fourth Ezra is the incredible role that's given to Ezra. That Ezra is the person, if you really want to know, who edited Tanakh. That's what it says in Fourth Ezra. Ezra was the editor of all of Tanakh. It never says that in rabbinic literature. We'll find in the medieval period, famous Rabbanim said that, but never says that in the Talmud or Midrash. But it does say it in this first century book of 4th Ezra. Because for those of you who read Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah, what does it say when Ezra and Nehemiah come and they read publicly? What do they read publicly before the Jewish people when they return from the Golah? Torah Moshe. They don't read Tanakh. They read the Torah. Not a word is said about Nevi'im and Ketuvim. Okay. So what is Torah, Nevi'im and Ketuvim? What are they? How does Torah differ from Nevi'im? How does Nevi'im differ from Ketuvim? Why do we have these categories? How did Chachamim, how did Chazal understand Torah, Nevi'im and Ketuvim? How do we understand it today? No one phrased this more appropriately than Don Yitzchak Abarbanel. Abarbanel, of course, as you know, was that great Jew who was for a while advisor to the King of Portugal, born in 1437. He had to flee for his life in the middle of the night on a horse, left his wife and children in Portugal, Lisbon, and came to Castile. He came to Ferdinand and Isabella. It took a very short time when they realized who it was that they had, and he became an advisor to Ferdinand and Isabella. There's even a document, a real document that exists to this day, that Don Isaac Abarbanel lent money to the crown, to Ferdinand and Isabella, which was used to finance a certain Christopher Columbus on a trip in search of the West Indies, and he found America. Thanks to Don Isaac in part. And that same Don Isaac of Abarbanel, when he wasn't advising kings, he was learning Tanakh. It's amazing. He studied Tanakh. And he wrote beautiful commentaries on Tanakh. And in his Akdamah to Sefer Yehoshua, in particular, is where he formulated the questions that need to be asked, perhaps better than anybody else. And Don Yitzchak Abarbanel says as follows. He says that he doesn't even understand what the words mean, Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. Makes no sense to him. Because the word Torah really means teaching. It's an abstract noun. The teaching, the Torah, the law, if you want to read it that way, the teaching. So Torah, is, if it means the law or the teaching, it means the book Torah is called Torah because of its content. This is the content of the Torah is laws, mitzvot, teaching how a Jew should live and so on. So apparently the sections of Tanakh are called after their content, right? So what should Nevi'im be called if that's true? What should Nevi'im be called if that's true? Nevuah. If Torah is Torah because of its content, so what does Nevi'im contains? Nevuah. Should be called Nevuah. Nevi'im means prophets. If Nevi'im is called Nevi'im because it is authored by Nevi'im, what were the Nevi'im? Nevi'im were prophets. The authors were prophets, right? So then Torah should be called Hanavi. The greatest of the prophets was Moshe. And if you look at Ketuvim, so what does Ketuvim mean? What does Ketuvim mean? Writings. The writings, right? So what does that word reflect? What does writings mean? Right? It reflects form. What's the form? These books are writing. They're written. They're not oral. They're written, right? So if Ketuvim are called Ketuvim because of the form. So where does that leave Nevi'im, and where does the Torah? Nevi'im are written and Torah is also written. In his Hakdamat Yoshua and elsewhere in his writings, in many of the various books that he wrote, especially Mayanei HaYeshua, which I'll come back to in a while, Abarbanel asks some other very important questions. He says, Yishayahu was a Navi, Yirmiyahu was a Navi, Yechezkel was a Navi, and what was Daniel? Daniel was a Navi. And where is Daniel? Ketuvim. And Yishayah, Yermi, Yecheskel, Anaviim. How come? And in case you have any doubts about whether Daniel was a Navi, so let me assure you that there's a famous Braita in Sefet Megillah. And on your own, you can look at it. Sefet Megillah 14a, which says, Yoter me'ar Baruch ben Neria, Sroya ben Maasiya, Daniel, Mordechai Balshan, Chagai Zecharia, Malachi, Kulan nitnab'u, Bishnat Shtayim l'Daryavish. Whole long list of people, all of them who prophesied in the second year of Daryavish, and Daniel was on the list. For the Chachamim, there was no question. Daniel was a Navi. So why is Daniel in Ketuvim? Yes. Why not? Well, not all of Nuvuah was preserved. There's a famous passage in the Chachamim. Unlike Professor Haran, the Gemara says, Nuvuah shehutzucha ledorot nichtiva. That is, there were many prophets. What got into Tanakh was a selection, and those prophecies that were thought to be necessary and useful for all generations were included in Tanakh. So yes, there are many Nevi'im who didn't get into Tanakh, but the point is, all Nevi'im should be in Nevi'im. Why is Daniel in Ketuvim? That's the question. Okay, I'm gonna come to your answer in a minute. Let me simply say that indeed, what did modern scholarship conclude with regard to this question of Abarbanel? They didn't know it from Abarbanel, but they asked a similar question, and they simply concluded the answer is Daniel is a late book. They said Daniel was not written by Daniel, because had it been written by Daniel, it would have been part of Nevi'im. Nevi'im was closed already. Remember, we spoke about the development that took place. First there was Torah, then Torah was closed, then there was Nevi'im. Nevi'im was closed. You want to know why Daniel is in Ketuvim? Modern scholarship solution, answer is, he was too late. He couldn't get into Nevi'im. It's closed already. The only part that was still open in the time of whoever wrote Daniel, you see, was the collection called Ketuvim, and so all the late books made it in, as it were, made it into the Ketuvim. Absolutely. For the lateness of Sefer Daniel, yes. You mean the proof for the lateness of... Yes, yes, fits in. They view this as... All of it, all the pieces fitting together very nicely. Okay. The first Gadol who addressed this issue for our purposes tonight, if you really want to know, the first Gadol who addressed this was the Rif, but we don't have time now to go into the Rif. So I'm going to start with a Talmud of the Rif, namely the Rambam. The first Gadol who addressed himself in writing to the questions raised by Abarbanel about Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim was in fact the Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, in his Guide for the Perplexed, Book 2, Chapter 45. And the Rambam resolved the questions of Abarbanel with one fell swoop. And it is the Rambam who said what was being suggested now in the back. It was the Rambam who said that the difference between Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim has to do with levels of inspiration. Levels of inspiration. Torah was written by Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe was the greatest prophet who ever lived. Moshe could speak to God panim el panim. There's no other book in the Bible on the level of Torah. Hence, Torah is unique. Nevi'im, says the Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim, Nevi'im was written on the level of inspiration called prophecy, Nevuah, a very high level of prophecy. The Navi is a man possessed. The Navi is no longer in control of himself. The Navi is under the heavy hand of God. The Navi doesn't even know what hit him. When Nevuah comes, that's it. He's under the sway of God. He says whatever words God tells him to say. Read Sefer Yecheskel sometime and you'll get a sense of what it is to be under the heavy hand of God. Yecheskel does very strange things. He has no choice. Hence Nevuah. Ruach HaKodesh, says the Rambam, was a much lower level of inspiration. Ruach HaKodesh, you look like everybody sitting in the room now. You're comfortable. You don't feel a heavy hand of God on you. You can actually carry on a conversation with someone else if you wanted to. But what Ruach HaKodesh means is you're inspired as you write. Somehow a Holy Spirit enters you, and you write on a level higher, let's say, than your ordinary level. But you're in full control of your faculties. You know exactly who you are, where you are, what you're doing, and nothing will force you to do anything against your will. It's a lower level of inspiration. You're an inspired writer. That's Ketuvim. And Rambam says, you want to know why Sefer Daniel is in Ketuvim and not in the Nevi'im? Indeed, as was just suggested before, because the books in the Nevi'im were written by people under the heavy hand of God. They were written under the level of inspiration called Nevuah. Daniel is not on that level. Daniel is on a lower level. Level of inspiration, the same level as Mishlei, the same level as Shir HaShirim, the same level as Eicha. So Rambam. This view of the Rambam became the standard view. If you would ask the average man in the street, or woman, who's learned, this is the answer you would get. This is what you would hear. This is what I heard as a child. Whenever I asked about Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, the first thing I heard was this famous statement of the Rambam, that there are these three levels of inspiration. And indeed, I brought with me Sefer Tehillim, with the introduction of Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, who was it? Lived in Spain for a while, in Provence, and Rabbi David Kimchi, in his Hakdamat to Tehillim, gives a fine summary of this general view, and I will read it. V'yamru ki b'ruach ha-kodesh ne'mar zeh ha-sefer, l'fichach katvuhu b'chlal ha-ktuvim. He's wondering why Tehillim, which is who generally was, Tehillim is written by whom? David HaMelech. David HaMelech is in the Nevi'im. How come Tehillim is in Ketuvim? So he says, this book was written Ruach HaKodesh, that's why it's Bechlal HaKetuvim, ולא בכלל הנביאים, כי לא נאמרו דבריו בנבואה, כי הם ברוח הקודש. ונבאר אנחנו מעט מן ההפרש אשר בין נבואה ורוח הקודש, כי הנבואה הוא דבר בא על האדם שהוא חכם, שלם במידותיו, תבוא לו הנבואה בחלום, וביעת תבואהו הנבואה, והקיץ יתבטלו כוחות ההרגשיות, ויהיה מסולק מכל דרכי העולם. כן, the heavy hand of God falls on you. You're no longer part of this world. That's Nevuah. V'ruach HaKodesh hu sheyireh ha'adam ha-shalem mitasek b'divrei ha-Elohim shalem b'chol hargashatov lo titbatel achat mehem. You continue in your normal form, etc. Yes. In the Tshuvot Harif, I really don't want to take the time now, but it's going to lead us astray. There is a famous passage in Shishot HaRif where the Rif asked himself why we have various places in the Talmud where they make distinctions between Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. And the Rif answered, because they are different levels of inspiration. That's the first time we have the notion of levels of inspiration. That's in the Rif. And the Rambam then developed that in the Moreh Nevuchim. Okay? And so on. You should, on your own, please take a look at the Radak on Tehillim. He discusses Daniel here as well. It's a very important Radak. In essence, it summarizes everything I just said in the name of the Rambam. The Radak was a much younger contemporary of the Rambam. He was born in 1160. He died in 1235. But this view of the Rambam has many weaknesses. And again, who saw the weaknesses? None other than Don Isaac Abarbanel. And in his various books, he never tired of pointing out why he was not satisfied with this famous passage from the Rambam's Moreh Nevuchim. Even though, as we will see, Abarbanel was a man who not only studied Tanakh, he studied the Moreh Nevuchim as well. As a matter of fact, Abarbanel left a last will and testament, and in his last will and testament, Abarbanel wrote, there are only two books that a Jew should study. You know what they are? Tanakh, and what else? Moreh Nevuchim. Okay. But here he disagreed with the Rambam, because his reading of Tanakh didn't allow him to agree with the Rambam. And Abarbanel raised the following objections to the Rambam's three-tiered system of inspiration. First of all, Abarbanel said, if you look in the famous passage in Bava Batra, Yudaled Amudet, where the Talmud discusses the biblical books and the ordering of the biblical books and who wrote the biblical books, the Talmud says that Moshe wrote the Torah, and the Talmud says that Moshe wrote Sefer Iyov. So a view in the Talmud. Yet Torah is where? Torah is Torah. And Iyov is in Ketuvim. Why? Why should Iyov have been written in this low level of inspiration? The Talmud says that Shmuel wrote Sefer Shmuel, and the Talmud says that Shmuel wrote what else? Rut. Sefer Shmuel is where? In the Vim. Where is Sefer Rut? Ketuvim. Why? Why would they be the same author? Who was a Navi? Why would he write a book at a lower level of inspiration? Yirmiyahu, the Gemara says, wrote Sefer Melachim, and he also wrote Sefer Echa. Melachim is in Nevi'im, and Echa is in Ketuvim. Why? Why was he writing in these different levels of inspiration? And now if you have your Tanakh, so I'm going to ask you to open your Tanakh. Tehillim 18. If you open up your Tanakh to Tehillim 18, Yudchet. All right, you have Tehillim 18. Yudchet, it says, L'natzeach le'eved Hashem le'David, etc. And take a look at verse 3. That's all I need is verse 3. All right? Hashem, Sali, Umetzudati, Umefalti, etc. Right? And a whole long Tehillah, the famous Psalm, Psalm 18. Hold your finger on Psalm 18. Hold your finger there. And open up now to 2 Samuel 22. Shmuel Bet, Chaf Bet. 2 Samuel 22, verse 2. Shmuel Bet, chapter 22, verse 2. You see, Vayomar, Hashem, Sali, Umetzudati, Umefaltili, and read on, verse for verse, word for word, what you have in Psalm 18, you have in 2 Samuel 22. Some very minor differences, but essentially the same Tehillah. Now Abarbanel said, what's going on over here? How could the same Tehillah by the same author, in both places it's David, But in Sefer Shmuel, it's part of Nevi'im. And in Tehillim, it's part of Tuvim. How could that be? Now you see the weakness. Well, either this was said the Derech Nevuah, or was said the Derech. I understand that, but how could it be in Tuvim? You see, Rambam says a principle, and the principle is everything in Nevi'im is on the level of Nevuah. Everything in Tuvim is on a lower level. It's the same Perek. Right. Was which? How do you know? It could be it was Ketuvim. And how did it get into Nevi'im? Yes, and how did it get, but Shmuel is Nevi'im.
Another inspiration, he edited it, and he rewrote it at a higher level.
Yes. Right. Well, you realize there's a problem, right? In other words, you're being painted into a corner. So you first of all, it's wonderful you're defending the Rambam. I have no problem. You should do that. He knew how to learn. I mean, he obviously could have answered that, right? But one wonders why. It's very awkward. The same Perek, and this is not the only case, by the way. There are more cases. The same Perek is in Nevi'im and Ketuvim. It sure doesn't sound like these are different levels of inspiration. It's the exact same passage. David said this Shira once. You're right, it was copied twice, but then it can't be on the... One of these two levels is wrong. That's the problem. But this is his Tehillah. Take a look at the beginning of chapter 22. This is a Shira of David. No, it is. Take a look at the beginning, the same author at the beginning of Psalm 18 and Psalm 22. This Tehillah is his. There's only one. Excuse me? Perhaps. Can that be? In other words, the question is, so you're saying that Shmuel, whoever wrote Sefer Shmuel, right, was writing on a higher level of prophecy, and somehow he took this lower level of David and raised it to a higher level. Okay, you can say that, but it's... But then it should not be in the Nevi'im. Rambam's principle is, nothing can be in the Nevi'im unless it is written b'nevuah. By somebody else, you're saying. And it was demoted. Okay, all right, fair enough. You could say that. Barbanel wasn't too happy with that. Okay, but I think for good reason, very good reason. It's word for word. It's the same parasha. Make up your mind. Either it's Nevuah, it's Ruach HaKodesh. It's not both. Okay. You see, whoever wrote it, and it's clear that both texts say it was written by David. Now you have to make up your mind. But did David write it b'nevuah, or did he write it b'ruach hakodesh? Sefer Tehillim is ascribed to David. That's your problem. Give me a chance. Now, that's the problem that Abarbanel raised. Okay, I'll give you another. He had a very fine answer. You'll hear his answer in a minute. Okay, but the question is a very serious question. I could ask even a more serious question. Just read Sefer Yehoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Melachim, and read Divrei Hayamim. And you're going to tell me that one is b'nevuah and one is Baruch HaKodesh? If you didn't hear tonight that there was this view of the Rambam, or if you didn't know it before, you never would have suggested that. This is a history of the national history of Israel, and this is the national history of Israel. What's the difference? No author reading Yehoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, or Melachim would distinguish it in terms of its history, in terms of what it's the story that it's telling from Divrei Hayamim. There are different stresses and so on, but that this is b'nevuah and this is Ruach HaKodesh, why? What's b'nevuah here? One of the great Golei Sfarad, aside from the Nitzchak Abarbanel, was a great rabbinic scholar by the name of Rabbi Yosef Yaabetz. Rabbi Yosef Yaabetz, Yud Ayin Beit Sadi. He knew Abarbanel. In fact, he studied with Abarbanel, and he writes as follows. I'm reading from Sefer Or HaChaim of Rabbi Yosef Yaabetz, who was one of the Golei Sfarad in 1492, together with Abarbanel. He writes as follows. Gam Bador Haze Kamu Anashim Chachamim Nivonim B'Malchei Sfarad B'Malchut Portugal B'Frat B'Ir HaGdola Ir Ve'im B'Yisrael Ro'iti Kamoa B'Chol Yisrael Hi Ha'Ir HaNikreit Lisbona. So here we have an eyewitness account of someone who knew Abarbanel yet in Lisbon and studied with him. And he says, Ve'echad migdolei ha'ir hanizkeret, and one of the great rabbis of Lisbon, Gadol mirabban shemo, u'shmo noda v'nitparsein bi'iyim merov chochmato u'gdulato. He doesn't tell us the name, but it's very easy to understand. He's talking about Abarbanel. He says, Gadol mirabban shemo, which is a nice rabbinic phrase for he's greater than a rabbi. Abarbanel, how do you write Abarbanel? Aleph bet, Resh bet nun aleph lamed. Rabban, he has the name Rabban in his name. Gadol mi Rabban shmo, but his name is larger than Rabban. It's Abarbanel. Okay. So one of the great rabbis of Lisbon, Gadol mi Rabban shmo, u'shmo noda nitparsein bi'iyim erov chochmato u'gdulato. Chochmo u'gdula b'makom echad. There's no question this is Abarbanel. Namely, he was a great sage, and he was also a wealthy man, a great man, Chochma u'gdula b'makom echad, v'karov l'melachim, and he mixed with royalty. Tza'ak tamid b'chiburav alei lehanashim, gam ani lamadeti k'sat prakim mi'perush me'hamore asher nitchakem bo mikol ha'adam acherei shechubar. I studied his perush on the Moreh Nevuchim. Abarbanel published the perush on Moreh Nevuchim, which is available now in the best editions of the Moreh Nevuchim. He said, I studied his perush on Moreh Nevuchim. And he was wiser than anyone else. Shenitchakem bo mikol adam, in his understanding of the Moreh Nevuchim. V'ra'inu ani v'chachamim asher shemanu mipiv, ki ha'efresh shebein hazahav ha'nechoshet, hu ha'efresh shebein perusho l'shara perushim. The difference between Abarbanel and all other commentators on the Moreh Nevuchim is as the difference between gold and copper or bronze. Ma leteven et habar. V'acharei shehaya mifareish kavanat harav. Now this is not in the printed book. This means only when he sat at the feet of Abarbanel and he heard Abarbanel teach. Acharei shehaya mifareish kavanat harav. After he would explain what the Rambam said, ba'er heitev haya omer, Abarbanel used to say, Zo kavanat Rabbeinu Moshe. What I just taught you was the understanding of Maimonides. Lo kavanat Moshe Rabbeinu. But that was not the understanding of Moshe Rabbeinu. That was Abarbanel. So here too, we're going to have another case of that. Abarbanel had a very different understanding, you see, of Tanakh here than the Rambam. He argued with the Rambam. And he made a very interesting suggestion. And the hour is late, so I'm just going to basically summarize it for you. What Abarbanel said was, with great insight, is there's no difference between Nevi'im and Ketuvim. Absolutely no difference. In terms of level of inspiration, no difference. And as a matter of fact, there's a marvelous halakha, which in effect proves the point. Because in the Talmud, we have a halakha that says that you can't put a Torah on Nevi'im, you can't put Nevi'im and Ketuvim on top of the Torah, or even a Chumash. You can't put Nevi'im on top of a Chumash. You can put a Chumash on top of Nevi'im and Ketuvim. But Nevi'im and Ketuvim, you can put a Ketuvim on top of Nevi'im, or Nevi'im on top of Ketuvim, interchangeable. And that is the halakha in the Shulchan Aruch. No one ever changed the halakha. That is the halakha. And let me tell you, you can always go by the instincts of halakha. Halakha says there's no difference in the level of Kiddusha of Nevi'im and Ketuvim. And Abarbanel said there's no difference in terms of level of inspiration between Nevi'im and Ketuvim. Torah, yes. Torah is the highest level.
Torah are the laws that were given by God through Moshe Rabbeinu. No other laws can be given through another prophet in the same manner. Mitzvot come from Moshe Rabbeinu. Torah is on the highest level. After Torah, there is Nevi'im and Ketuvim. Why are there two sections, one called Nevi'im and one called Ketuvim? And Abravanel says something that's quite amazing. He said, Nevi'im is a history of the prophets who came and were sent by God to preach to the Jews. It is a history of the kings and prophets. It picks up where the Torah left off, and it ends with Churban Bayit Rishon. From Yoshua through Melachim, including Yishayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Treyasar, and so on. Nevi'im is Nevuah, has all the prophets. And Ketuvim has no such unity. Ketuvim is a third section of Tanakh. It is not the history of the Jews from one period or another period. It's a conglomeration of different kinds of books, mostly Chochmah, Mishlei, Iyov, Tehillim, mostly books of wisdom, the various Megillot. There are books in Ketuvim that could be older than the Nevi'im. Could have been written before the Nevi'im. Maybe Iyov is older than any book in the Nevi'im. Who knows? There's no difference in level of inspiration. There's difference in function. Nevi'im is a history of Nevuah, of prophets that were sent to Israel. In Ketuvim, we do not have a history of the prophets that were sent to Israel. So now you'll ask, why is Daniel in Ketuvim? Right? What's the answer? Why is Daniel in Ketuvim? Read Sefer Daniel. Read from the beginning to the end. 12 chapters. Read the whole Sefer Daniel. And you know what you'll find? What? Part Aramaic. Part Aramaic and part Hebrew. But what will you find in Sefer Daniel? Daniel was never sent to the Jewish people. He never delivers a message to any Jew and to any group of Jews. He is not like Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel. He is not what modern scholars call an apostolic prophet. He wasn't sent on shlichut. Daniel is a private Jew. Yes, he meets with great people. There are all kinds of interactions and stories, but all those stories are between Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, or Daniel and other heroes, and leading figures in Babylon. Never does it say that God appears to Daniel and tells Daniel, Daniel, go to Bnei Israel and say. No messages in Daniel. Not like Yechezkel, not like Yirmiyahu, and not like Yeshayahu, where it says, Ne'um Hashem. You'll never find Ne'um Hashem in Sefer Daniel. Abarbanel says this. Great insight. He looked at the form and he said, Daniel is Chochmah, is wisdom. And Daniel wrote his book. Daniel never spoke to another Israelite. Never delivered his message, unlike Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, who in the first instance are oral prophets. Daniel was an armchair prophet. Daniel sat at his study in his house, and he wrote Sefer Daniel. Never spoke to other Jews. That's not the same as Nevuah. Might be the same level, but it's a different function entirely, and that belongs in Ketuvim. Yes. Yonah is a Nevi'im. Yonah is sent. Yonah is a shliach. He's sent by God to Nineveh. Sure. Yonah. Yonah is an apostolic prophet. Yonah runs away. Yonah is a shliach. It doesn't have to be to Bnei Israel in the first instance. And by the way, elsewhere in Sefer Melachim and so on, Yonah is sent to Bnei Israel. But in this story in Sefer Yonah, he was sent to... It doesn't matter who you're sent to, but the fact is you have to be sent. That, yeah, of course. And Yechezkel too. Both. That's fine. But they are sent on shlichut. Daniel is not sent on shlichut. This is very insightful. And now, I want you to take a look at two psukim in Tanakh. In this kind, Abarbanel doesn't cite these psukim, but I think they're wonderful and should be cited together with Abarbanel's theory.
If you'll take a look now at Yirmiyahu 18:18. Yirmiyahu 18:18. We have a verse here which is very, I'm interested in the second part of the verse, which categorizes Jewish literature, ancient Israelite literature. This is the Sefer Yirmiyahu. And it says, Ki lo tova Torah mikohen, Torah, law, one kind of authoritative literature that comes, those decisions are made by the Kohen. Eitzah mechacham, advice, wisdom. Wisdom comes from the Chacham. Davar minavi. Here you have it already. Here in ancient, in Nevuah, in Sefer Yirmiyahu, is the recognition that there are three kinds of Jewish literature. You want to know where Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim begin? It begins in ancient Israel. It didn't begin, as the modern scholars say, Ketuvim was invented by the rabbis. There was always an ancient Jewish literature, and there were three different kinds of literature. There was a literature known as Torah, there was something known as Nevuah, and there was something known as Chochmah. And these are three different genres of literature, recognized here by Yirmiyahu. And now take a look at Yechezkel 7, 26, Ezekiel 7, 26, and lo and behold, you'll find the same thought in Sefer Yechezkel. Mesiach lefi tumo, this is Derech Agav, 7, 26. Bikshu chazon mi navi, from the navi you get chazon, Torah tovad mi kohen, ve'etzah miskenim. So I must say this is very suggestive, and it seems to me that from earliest antiquity there existed side by side Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. What form these had in antiquity, I don't know. I can't prove it. But it's not that we have a development of first there was Torah, then there was Nevi'im, then there was Ketuvim, which is what modern scholars tell us. But indeed, from earliest times, there were three different kinds of authoritative literature. These were distinguished. And I don't doubt when the decision was made to make a biblical canon, they took all three at the same time. And they had Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. This seems to be... Okay, maybe oral, but there are three categories. That's right, what I really want out of the three categories.
He's saying what you should seek Hazon and Avi, you're still saying.
Okay.
But you're not really referring to a body of literature. You're not referring to... Because we always knew, even from the Torah, you don't need to be the Torah, that the Kohen's function is different than the Nevi's function.
That's right.
And different than the Nasi.
That's right. Okay, but what... My eye noticed here was the three categories, that there are three categories. And these three categories are exactly what we now have and what's preserved. That can't be an accident. We have three categories. And it has nothing to do with historical development, and I personally believe it has nothing to do, as the Rambam said, with levels of inspiration. It had very much to do with three different functions. And we would do well to study the functions of Torah vis-a-vis Nevuah, vis-a-vis Eitzah or Chochmah. And by the way, in the Talmud, that third section very often is referred to as Chochmah. There's a famous passage in Yerushalmi which uses, instead of Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, uses Torah, Nevi'im, Chochmah as the third section. And as you well know, there are many other rabbinic passages which, when they cite a verse from Mishlei or Shir HaShirim, they say, Shlomo Amar B'Chochmato. Chochmah was a technical term for this literature. Anyway, I kept you long enough. I want to close by stating the following, that whatever doubts we have about the history of the biblical canon, as you can see, these are matters that are being discussed and not easily resolved. We have very few traditions about how Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim developed. But at least what I can speak with authority about is what will happen in the end of times.
The reason I can speak with authority about that is because there's a famous passage in the Yerushalmi Megillah 70d, which says that in the end of times, the biblical canon will consist only of Torah. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Hanaviyim Vaktuvim Atidin Libatel. The Chamesha Tzifrei Torah Einan Atidin Libatel. So somehow at the end of times we will only have Torah, not Neviim and Ketuvim. If that is true, at least that was the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan, I want to serve notice to everyone here that you had better study Yeshaya, Yirmiyahu, Yecheskel as soon as you can and get it in while they're still part of the biblical canon. Thank you very much.